Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're with us today. I want to remind you that this is Public Community Radio, KCBX, and we want you to be part of the discussion. And you can give us a call. Write the phone number down once and you'll have it forever, or store it in your phone. It's 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. This is Central Coast Voices, and Central Coast Voices is with you every week at this time. And it is a product and a production of the Action for Healthy Communities, which is part of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. And our goal is to bring you basically credible, valid information and insights from diverse members of our community on diverse topics. And we want to address how today's choices affect tomorrow's community. And sometimes that means change. Sometimes that means going back to things we've done before. Sometimes it just means looking at new things and new ways of looking at stuff. Today, we're going to talk about better designs for a better environment. And exactly what that means is a rather complex topic that we'll get into in a little bit. My guests today are fascinating people involved with a fascinating part of building a better community by better design, and hopefully a better environment in the process. I want to also remind you that part of Action's goals is to make sure that there is a better understanding of San Luis Obispo County for everyone. And we put out a report about every 3 years, and the last report came out in December of 2013 and is called Vital Signs, Understanding San Luis Obispo County. You can have a copy of the report or review it at www.actionslo.org. And I do realize that works without the www, but I'm old enough to believe the www somehow still means important. So that's with us on that. We have a lot of things that go on in our community. We can debate about some of them. We can argue about some of them. I believe our world became less argumentative about the environment, at least for me last weekend. I was actually driving back from the Bay Area and saw something that I found to be a fascinating commentary on society. And I saw a Nissan Leaf, which is a 100% electric vehicle put out by Nissan, with a rather what I would consider radical to semi-radical right-leaning bumper sticker. I do believe the world has come to understand better what we need to do about the environment when what I would consider both extremes of the political spectrum are together on one person's car. So that's just my observation about that, and that may not mean anything at all, but it did make me feel better. Again, this is Central Coast Voices. Our phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. We would like you to be part of the discussion, and I encourage you to be part of the discussion in the earlier part of the hour. If you want to be part of the discussion in the last 8 or 9 minutes, you don't get much time because we're trying to wrap things up. But for some reason, an awful lot of people want to have the last word, and I would encourage you to not do that today if possible. Better design for a better environment is an interesting topic to broach. Basically, about 39% of the energy that the country expends is used to build buildings. About 12% of the water we consume is to build buildings, and about 68% of the electricity is used to build buildings. And there are ways to do it where we don't necessarily have to do that. And my guests today are Turco Sims, who's the founder of Sims & Company Builders, and they're a sustainable builder in the area, and Ken Haggard, who is the principal architect with San Luis Obispo Sustainability Group, who I think also his claim to fame is that he has probably been the person in the community that's been working on sustainable issues the longest. And he's with us. And Steve Wyman. And Steve's definition of himself is interesting because he's a fascinating fellow, and we have had a chance to talk in a number of times. But he would describe himself in this discussion as just a guy who happens to live in a straw bale home. And these are the fellows that we have with us today, and we're going to talk about sustainable building and what you may know about it, what you want to know about it, what you don't know about it, and what you should know about it. And we probably need to start with some definition, and I'll give it to Ken, as to what a sustainable building is and what sustainable building is as a discipline.
Well, it's really two approaches to that. One's a positive side and one's a negative side. The positive side is here we live in probably one of the most ideal parts of the world to live in, and yet we seal ourselves in buildings that make no cognizance of where we are. And we don't need to do that. I mean, we have this fantastic Mediterranean light, but everybody's in sitting under fluorescent tubes or whatever. We aren't really optimizing where we are. And the idea of a sustainable building is that we use the forces of nature that are all around us to heat, cool, light, ventilate, collect water, all that kind of stuff. And our climate is very easy to do that. So that's a positive approach to that.
Okay.
The negative is, if I can,
go ahead,
is that we have a bit of a crisis going in terms of the climate, pretty obvious, and water and whatnot. And we're going to build buildings anyway. So why don't we build them in a way that helps solve those problems rather than exacerbate them? And our buildings can be ride the horse in the way it's going. I guess it's a Chinese thing, which is a way of saying let's take the win-win approach to these problems.
Okay, so let's talk about where you live, and I visited your office. I visited, and that has your home attached to it. Mm-hmm. If I were to look at it and knew nothing about sustainable building, I would assume it maybe had been built in the last 5 to 7 years, because that seems to be when, in my mind, every sustainable building was built in the last 5 to 7 years, and Turco's rolling his eyes because he's been doing it for a lot of years.
Yeah.
We think of this as new technology, but in reality, we're talking about a technology that's been around for a long time. It just hasn't been used very proficiently on a regular basis. In somebody's comments, I'm not quite sure which one of you it came from, there are already over 200 just straw bale buildings, not counting other buildings in the area that are that are built that way. We have some the Jewish community, which is I think Congregation Beth David over on Las Rosas Valley Road is a straw bale building. Claiborne and Churchill Winery over on Edna Valley Road is a straw bale building. All you had to do is walk in that building in particular any afternoon when it's 90 degrees outside, and you can understand what straw bale feels like. But it's not all about that. It's about I guess, what you've conveyed to me is it's a way of life. It's an understanding. Actually, and Steve has too. It's a way of not just how you build but how you live, and that's what we want to look at. Steve, you built a straw bale house.
Right.
It so happens that Sims & Company was the contractor, I guess, on the project.
That's right. We had something to do with it, but they did a lot of it.
What was involved in that decision for you? And I guess, what was the impetus to go in that direction?
Yeah, well, we, back in Tucson, when we lived in Tucson, we began to get the idea, my wife, Lori, and I, of building more sustainably. At that point in time, I'd actually not heard the word sustainability, but we'd taken some permaculture classes and had begun to orient in that direction. And originally, we were looking at rammed earth and going to some presentations by folks. We ran into straw bale. That was in the early 90s around, and straw bale was in a revival. And soon afterwards, we did some work with Habitat for Humanity in Tucson and built a home. After that experience, we decided that that was for us, and it became just a matter of time until we could build our own place. We began to look for that opportunity. So yeah. We knew we were going to do it when we came here.
Okay. And you live on the west edge of Atascadero.
Yep.
On a hill facing southwest.
Straight south.
Okay, straight south. Okay. And on a 90-degree day, can you survive in your house?
Absolutely. Yeah.
You have no air conditioning. I know that.
Yeah, okay. And it's not just the 90-degree day. Yeah. I recall when we were doing finish work on the house, we were doing getting ready to put up plaster. There were just doors hanging in the doorway, but they weren't sealed yet. I mean, there was no weather stripping. There's no knobs on the doors. We're basically still open to the elements to some degree. And you stood in that house, and it was winter. It was a cold day out. You stand in the house in the doorways, and you could feel the difference just standing in the doorway of the retention of the heat of the slab and things of that nature. So it does work both for the heating and cooling.
Yeah, you're not only saving energy, but you're getting better comfort because it's radiantly coupled. Mm-hmm. It's a radiant system, and it's way more comfortable than these forced air things, which are, you know, all noisy and grinding and dry.
Yeah, I live in Atascadero also, and we don't have air conditioning in our house, but I have a portable air conditioner in my office because I fry there often. And I probably get less tolerant of the noise of it than I do of the heat often, so I get shut off. Turco, you do sustainable building, and you do all kinds of building, I know, but how did you get involved in this, and where do you think it's going?
I got involved in this, well, because when I was at Cal Poly, I hooked up with Ken Haggard back in the early 70s and several other key people in the area who were teaching in And there was a bit of an oil embargo going on, and everybody was finally getting aware of the limited resource of energy. And I just wanted to build a more energy-efficient home. It wasn't about straw bale at that time. It wasn't about the holistic part of it. It was basically making it more energy-efficient, doing the heating and cooling naturally. I understood and learned some of the systems. And, you know, we built a lot of houses there in the 70s and 80s that were very simple houses that still today only use $25 a month of electricity. They don't have photovoltaics. They don't have straw bale. They just are well designed, as Ken said, to fit in and use our environment. The sun is an energy source. It's not just petroleum and coal and liquid natural gas. It's an energy source. And so you've just got to design a house that couples that and uses it to both heat and cool. So you can have a house that stays beautifully cool in the summertime and also warm in the wintertime. Then life progresses. I'm building houses. And actually was on an airplane looking at British Columbia, flying back from Alaska, where I got really learned about straw bale. I looked at British Columbia, and I looked out of the plane as I was flying south, coming back, and it was just clear cut. And the rivers were running brown with silt and mud. And I picked up a magazine in the back that had an article about straw bale in it. And I was building a very, very large house in Varian Ranch at the time, and building thick wall construction out of 2x4s, and made a decision that I'm going to learn how to do this when I get back. And then at the same sort of time, Ken Haggard had a life-changing experience of losing his house in a fire and learned about straw bale, was doing straw bale, and we all sort of learned it together. I was very lucky at the timing of that. Straw bale is not the only house. We still build houses that are very sustainable and energy efficient today. But straw bale really has so many things going for it besides just the energy efficiency. It is the comfort. It's the inside plaster that you use that keeps the house at a stable temperature winter and summer. It's those thick walls. So the wall all of a sudden becomes a three-dimensional element rather than a two-dimensional element. So you're drawn into the openings. It's something rich about that. Fire protection. People think, oh, you got to be crazy. The three little pigs, huff and puff. Yeah. But it's really they've done tests, and a straw bale wall is very, very fire resistant.
So, like trying to burn a phone book.
Well, it's actually, I think Steve, where you're the comments, is it takes you, you get 3 weeks to get out of the
That's
house
right,
on fire.
Yeah. It just smolders.
Yeah, it's going to smolder. And that brings up an interesting question, and I'll get to it in a second. Let me remind folks that that we're talking about sustainable building today, and you're welcome to be part of this discussion. If you're just joining us, I have Turco Sims from Sims & Company, who does sustainable building. Steve Wyman, who's the owner of a straw bale home that actually he lives in and was part of the construction of, and Ken Haggard, who is an architect and a designer who's been involved in sustainable building for 20-plus years. He won't tell us how many plus the pluses is, but he's been involved in it for a long time. And anyway, you can give us a call at 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. This is, of course, Community Public Radio, KCBX, and you're part of the community. We'd like you to be part of the discussion. Yeah, Steve, one of your comments was that people assume you're going to burn down in a fire, and your comment was, well, it'll smolder, but it won't burn like wood, and it'll take you – you can have 3 weeks to get out of your house if something should actually catch on fire. So,
yeah, I'm sure that's a bit of an exaggeration, but the straw bales – are compacted.
If you hadn't noticed, you're in a room with people who exaggerate, so you're probably the least exaggerating of all of us, so that's good. Okay. Go ahead.
So the straw bale is heavily compacted, and I think it tends to smolder. I haven't personally lit one on fire to see what happens.
I have.
I have too.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I'm behind the
They're
times,
still here. Okay, so we'll find out what's involved in that.
But, there's no really capacity capacity for the air to get at it. And I think things like timber, you know, or the stick frame is going to burn better. And the things that might catch are more like the eaves and other things that are vulnerable. And the design can be pretty careful about dealing with those. So we're in a high fire severity zone. And I think we're pretty comfortable with our defensible space and other aspects.
Yeah. Well, we got a couple of calls here. Let's see what's – okay. Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Okay. What are your thoughts?
Well, I just think it's a great idea. I've been interested in a long time. I understand some Cal Poly professors and students have been involved over the years. I think there's something just over the grade called Tassajara that had a straw bale structure.
That's where Ken Haggard lives.
Yeah, that's where
Chris.
Ken lives, yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, my questions are, is it financially comparable to a regular 2x4 frame house? And my other question is, what cities and is San Luis County friendly to straw bale homes from a permitting standpoint?
Right. Those are rather complex questions, and we'll get to them right away. Are you okay taking your answer off the air, or do you need to stay on the line?
No, I'm fine. Thanks. Great questions.
Thanks for calling in. Okay. All right, gentlemen. Okay. How much does it cost? And why can't I afford one?
Can you afford any houses in San Luis Obispo?
That's a good point.
Can you afford to buy the land?
Yeah.
You pay to live in San Luis Obispo.
Yes.
That's a whole discussion in itself. But it is a little more expensive up front, usually, because you're building a thicker wall. Main reason is you're building a thicker wall and you're putting plaster, stucco, on the inside as opposed to drywall. Everything else is the same. Windows, cabinets, you know, septic system, driveways, those are all the same.
Well, let me jump in for a second. If I wanted to build a lath and plaster structure, in other words, if I wanted more of an old-style house to be built, is it more expensive than lath and plaster, or it's just more expensive than the streamlined, cheap building that we do with drywall?
More expensive than the streamlined. If you were to build and try to do old lath and plaster, first of all, that would still be a fairly thin wall section. Mm-hmm. So if straw bale by far is the least expensive way to build a thick wall and get good insulation and get good energy efficiency and comfort. It by far, rammed earth, we've done all of them. We rammed earth, insulated concrete forms.
Okay. Keep that thought because we've got to find out what rammed earth is. That's a very, very strange
concept.
Go ahead, Ken.
The cost question should involve how much you're paying for to condition the building.
Mm-hmm.
If you take that into account, then you got to take that into account in the equation. It's probably less cost because you save so much money on the end fire question and so forth.
Those kind of trade-offs are things we look at. There's a number of people I know who own Nissan Leafs who basically talk about when they cranked into whether or not they wanted to buy a new commuter car, when they looked at the price of gas versus the price of a lease on a Leaf, they said, gee, you have to – if you take all those into account – you can buy a car that you weren't planning to buy based upon not paying for fuel. So you can also buy a house you weren't planning to buy or you weren't planning to have the expense to build based upon energy costs also. The caller also asked about going through the building process and how are government agencies on board with all everywhere now or are we still fighting that?
No.
But San Luis County – when Turco laughs, we know we're in trouble.
You know, okay, Chris, you're lucky in that San Luis Obispo County and most of the cities are pretty much on board with straw bale. They've gone through the learning curve. They've got it.
Yeah.
Santa Barbara is now on. It took a struggle. Santa Barbara cities have always been pretty supportive. Monterey County is still a challenge, and there are other counties in San Luis Obispo in California that are on board and not on board. And you can find out a lot of this information. I've got to plug one thing, and that's the California Straw Building Association. Their website is www.strawbuilding.org.
Okay.
Or just look up CASBA, CASBA, but you will find out lots of information there.
I wanted to come back to the financial question for just a second because I had a little different perspective. When you're thinking about building a home, the first thing to me was, you know, is this a custom home or is it not a custom home? I mean, at some point, you know, there's more – the cost to me is swamped by the decision to build something custom or not. I think the straw bale part of that is somewhere down in the noise, you're talking about some small differences from the perspective of the builder.
Yeah.
But, you know, from our perspective, we could easily manage that down into the decisions that we made the finishes, or whether or not we used a lot of square or round kinds of finishes and things, the way we made it simple or not simple. So we were able to manage that. And for us, it would have been equivalent.
Okay. Good point.
All right. I want to remind you folks, this is Central Coast Voices, and we're talking about sustainable home building and both what's involved and what isn't involved in doing that. You can give us a call at 805-781-3875. I'm Fred Monroe. This is Central Coast Voices. If you're just joining us now, we'll be with you for a while longer. So we would certainly welcome having your call in the discussion. Ken, you had something before we go to our next caller. You had something to
answer. Oh, that question about the regulation stuff. From a big picture standpoint, sustainability is a big problem in California of getting rid of rice straw because we grow so much rice here. And it used to be they burn it, and we produce more air pollution burning rice straw than anything else. So the state encourages you to build with straw bale construction. The regulations are local, but there's enabling legislation at the state level for using that material because it's a waste product, essentially. Okay.
Yeah, we have Cam on the line with a question about water usage and such. Cam, are you there?
Yeah, hi.
Okay. What's your question?
I just wanted to say we live on rainwater up here. We're just up above Turco's. Hey, Turco.
Oh, hi, Cam.
Okay.
I got some straw back from...
We told Turco his friends couldn't call in, but that didn't work. Okay, go ahead.
Anyways, it's getting drier, and houses are great machines for water collection, and we just got signed off after 4 years of the permitting process, and all our water is gray water. All the plants and landscaping we have come from our sinks and showers and all that, and I just wondered if you guys were gonna maybe get into that a little bit and the importance of designing around that resource.
Yeah. What do you folks – well, tell us what you think.
It's a bigger –
thanks for the call.
Cam, thank you for the call. Thank you for the call. And it's a good point. I mean, we're talking about the walls here and straw bale and the energy use, but the water is probably even bigger to talk about. And we are just beginning, really, to understand both the limited resource it is for a lot of people – in this county and throughout the world, and also some of the solutions we can have in rainwater catchment, in gray water use. And there has been some good movement made in this county, and I know it took quite some time to get his whole system sort of permitted and approved. But we can do that. You can do that. It's also a way of thinking of how do I use my water? How much water do I use? How long a shower do I take? What do I wash with? So anyway, I have to start the discussion.
Yeah. And by the way, Michael, I know you're on hold, and we'll get to you in a second. But one of the things that concerned me, and you mentioned it, Ken, and I'd like to go back to it so we don't forget it, is that my first thought was, gee, you actually have a crop you have to grow to make straw bales. But your answer briefly was there's more straw than we know what to do with, and we used to burn it off, or still in some cases burning it off. So is there a concern of running out of materials? How much straw is there out there available?
Oh, way more than if we built every building in the state out of straw bale, we still have plenty of straw. We got way more material because we have the industrial agriculture that's building, right, doing all this rice.
So that's not a concern because we talk about sustainable agriculture. I'd hate to discover that we have to grow more things we don't need otherwise in order to have a residual of straw in the process.
Well, I just wanted to mention about the water usage. It's ironic to me that this morning I was looking at a piece in the Tribune, and Kathy Tanner, I think, had a column on the use of water in Cambria. Everybody's trying to conserve. And for us back at the time when we built the house, that was a harder thing to deal with in terms of the reception to something like building in gray water systems than dealing with something like the straw bale. And it's just ironic to me that we go through all these manual systems. We're washing our dishes in a tub and taking the water outside and dumping it on the plants. You could build those kinds of systems right into the house if people would be a little friendlier, I think, with respect to the gray water usage.
Yeah. And if you really calculate, and we've done this on this recently, Green Build has a whole pamphlet on rainwater harvesting. If you look at the rainfall, different parts of the county, and the size of roofs, we could be most of our buildings could be self-sufficient in terms of water if you would use all the water off the roof. But that involves design a pretty big cistern because of our climate.
Well, so, I think in a lot of cases, as we get people more acclimated towards sustainable things, I mean, we went from hardly any solar-powered houses 10 years ago to now people waiting in line for the right to get solar panels built in new construction and old construction, in some cases with no upfront cost. So I think if we get people's mind, and Ken, you and I talked about this when we visited out at your property before, that it's getting people to pay attention. It's getting the people to think about it. And once they start thinking about it, they're open to having a discussion about what they can do beyond just having Turco show up with his trailer full of straw.
Anyway. But the water's a big thing, and I think some of the regulations still have a ways to go, but we're working on that. And this drought's getting everybody's attention. And I hope for progress in our regulations on that soon.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Michael, you're with us from San Luis Obispo. What are your thoughts or questions?
Well, thank you. First off, I'd like to give appreciation and gratitude for Ken and Turco and Steve and what they do in this community to keep educating people. But my question is, and I'll ask it and get off the phone, is it seems there's a little bit increased cost in water conservation technologies, the solar application, a more intentional building that has better insulation, and we're forced in this area where we have developers that are in the business of developing properties, and they have to keep costs down. What resources are in place to help us with these upfront costs, but long-term savings, so that the developers can develop properties and do them in a sustainable green manner? And just want to hear your guys' thoughts on, how we can move forward from a development standpoint where they're doing multi-family projects. Okay. And thank you.
Thanks for the call. Who wants to jump in first?
Well, I want to thank Michael for calling. Michael Robertson is also a very dedicated member of the sustainable community, and his business, Green Goods, give them a little plug. Does a great job at promoting sustainable materials. Thank you. Thank you for calling in, Michael. It's a challenge, and it does have to, sort of pencil, as he says, make it pencil. And you got to look at the short term. How much does it cost up front? How much is it long term? But there are certain things you can do that don't cost anything, and that starts with the design. It starts with how you plan your developments so that you plan for the proper use of the sun easily with houses naturally without having to push them contorted shapes on the lot. It starts with how you face the windows, how you design the overhangs. It's a big part of the design solution on those things where they really could make the biggest bang for their buck long-term with a very small upfront cost.
Right. The simplest things are usually the most neglected things, and none of those things that Turco mentions generally cost anymore. The only thing it costs anymore in a passive solar house maybe is getting some thermal mass in the building. Mm-hmm. But everything else, same amount of glass, just put it in the right place. The biggest problem I had with architects is they don't want to face buildings south. It somehow hurts their creativity. Well, a good designer should be able to use the south sun and make it work within the building and still have their creative expression and all that stuff. And I'm all for expression.
Yeah. So, let me remind you, this is Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe, and I have three fascinating fellows today, and we're talking about sustainable building. We'd like you to be part of the discussion. The phone number is 781-3875. This is Community Radio KCBX, and you're part of the community. We'd like you to be part of the discussion. I want to jump in. We have Stella from Arroyo Grande. Stella, are you there? Would you like to join the discussion?
I am. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us.
I'm a member of the San Luis Obispo Botanical Garden, and I believe we have a beautiful building there for events, and I believe it was built by Sims and Company, and it was a straw built.
No, I can't. I can't take credit for that, but it was designed by it was built by a lot of Cuesta students. Students did it, but Ken Haggard and his group designed it and really managed it, and Rich Beller was another key player in that. Great building.
It's a beautiful building. And I have a question. Does it matter whether it's commercial building or residential building as to whether the county will allow it?
No.
Okay. Yeah, generally, well, your building would technically be a commercial building out at
right.
the, and that's actually sitting on a county-owned parcel,
right.
I believe.
Right.
Okay. We mentioned earlier that Claiborne and Churchill Winery on Edna Valley is a straw bale building. And actually, the only way you can really tell for sure that's a straw bale building from the outside is this: the basically the insets for windows make it very noticeable, and they have the I don't know what you call it, but the proverbial you can scratch this straw to verify it's a straw bale building.
It's called a truth window.
Truth window.
You got to have a truth window.
Farmer designed that building. So yeah, give her a plug on that one. It was the first straw bale commercial building in the state. Okay. Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Stella.
Thank you.
Take care. Hardy, let's see. While we've got those and we haven't gone someplace else here, let me drop it. There we go. I'm sorry. I didn't drop it. There we go. Sorry about that. And we have John from Atascadero. What are your thoughts, John?
Oh, hi. On your straw bale, thank you very much. Kind of interesting program. Straw bale is not really structural. Don't you need a steel frame in it for earthquakes? Or is it a, you know, you don't need any steel inside the straw?
There's several approaches there. You can do structural straw bale. We've done one and got it approved at our place. Most of them, though are some kind of frame, so often a wood frame that it's in what we call an infill system. But you can, under certain circumstances, use the straw structurally if then let the skin be the structure. That's the stucco, because the stucco really adheres nicely to the bale. Bale makes a great tooth for straw bale, for the stucco. And then you got a shell, essentially. If you use it like a shell, it can be structural.
Yeah. One of my first questions when I was visiting Ken and looking at their parcel out there was I thought you had to put lath on the outside of the straw in order to get stucco and plaster to stick.
Yeah, right.
And I think someday I'll go out to one of Turco's site and see a demonstration of how they're actually putting the stucco on. Because my first impression was, how do you get it to stick without it just kind of falling apart? But
right.
I've been reassured that it actually does work that way. And Ken's how long ago was your house built, Ken?
About 18 years ago.
So 18 years ago. And I can attest to the fact his walls are still intact and they don't feel like they look like they're falling off.
How thick is the structure of the plaster outside, the cement plaster?
It's about an inch to an inch and a half.
Yeah.
Really?
And we same. Do what drives the need for more of a infill with post and beams in our state is earthquakes.
Uh-huh.
And engineering and rules and regulations. In a lot of the world, for very, very simple housing, it's just you stack up straw bales on a foundation and you put some kind of top cap on that, wooden or concrete or something, and attach your roof to that and strap it down to the ground. The largest collection of straw bales, and that'd be a good question to ask, but it's hard to ask over the radio, is where are the most straw bale houses built? What country has the most straw bale houses? And the answer is Mongolia has the largest collection of straw bale homes because the weather is radical and they've been introduced there. A lot of California architects and builders have gone over and helped facilitate that, as well as people from all the world. So it's such a great energy. And they put straw bale in the roof, too, because it's a very severe climate.
Yeah.
How thick is the wall plaster inside?
About the same.
Oh, about an inch and a half?
Yeah, mm-hmm. inch and a half. It's the walls are not – if you want a perfectly flat house – walls, don't build a straw bale. Build it out of concrete blocks or something.
Well, yeah, actually, let me back up. I mean, I've seen Steve's property, and I've seen Ken's. Steve's is reasonably straight as far as the walls. Well, Ken, I think Ken's, you've probably designed it specifically, you like a three-flowing space.
Intentionally wiggly, yeah. Okay.
But exactly. You go out to Claiborne and Churchill, and that's a pretty doggone square-on plum building with pretty flat walls.
Might say one more thing about the interior stucco. If you just want thermal mass for cooling, distributed mass for cooling, or spread all out so you can vent at night and cool it down, the optimum thickness, and we've run computers and analysis, it's about 2 inches. So the stucco on the straw bale ends up almost optimum for getting your thermal mass you need for the building, which is
the electrical and plumbing is put in the straw inside the walls and stuff.
Well, the electrical is, but plumbing we try to keep out of the straw bale.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
We do have to put it in there sometimes.
Thanks for the
call. Put it in a conduit or a sleeve.
You know, there's also plenty of opportunities that people do volunteer kinds of things, and when the volunteers do such things as putting on plaster, and I've had an opportunity to do that like at Camp Ocean Pines, you get some variation in that amount, right? And so part of this is when you talk about wavy walls, if you'd actually looked at our place from the side, you'd see that waviness. Yeah. It depends a little bit on who built that wall. And there's some value in squaring that up before they put all that plaster on if you're talking about keeping the cost down. Yeah.
It's an interesting question because, Steve, you're outside in your back patio. There's an outside fence or wall that's straw bale.
Yeah.
You said there's some wood in that for stability. But
well, it's at the base.
At the base.
Yeah.
But that indeed, you lean – I mean, my first thought was I don't want to lean against this. It's going to fall over. But, my God, it's real solid.
Well,
yeah.
I'll tell you, because my reaction to the earthquake aspect is I personally would feel more comfortable in a house like this. When we were in Tucson, living in Tucson, one of the habitat houses we worked on was a load-bearing. It had a come-along, a cable that went from the bottom, and they used they cinched that thing down. And I'm telling you, I think you could run a truck into that thing and not knock it over.
You can. No, you can. And the load-bearing does do very well. And there are test results that have been done that have been funded a lot by the California Straw Building Association and the rice growers of California to find an outlet for their rice straw. They have done a lot of testing, very elaborate earthquake testing in labs. I mean – $500,000 type worth of testing that are proving that a straw bale wall is just you put these two rigid outside veneers of plaster with there is some actual structural steel and it's tied together. You get a box beam effect.
Yeah.
In the center, a center part, the straw takes the shock. And they've held up incredibly well, but there's a ways to go until we can get it approved and engineered.
I want to get back to the question of what you do. I'll get to it in a second. We've got Paul on the line, though. I don't want to keep him waiting.
Okay.
But when we get back after the call with Paul, I'm curious as to what you do if somebody backs into your straw bale house to fix it, so we can talk about repairs. Okay. Paul, are you there?
Yep, I'm here. Okay.
What are your thoughts or questions?
It's great to have this panel on your radio show.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And glad to have all you guys there to feel – this question, a lot of us that have been involved in the Green Belt movement for a long time, it seemed like a lot of our dividends have paid off in terms of more stringent requirements with Title 24 and methods that are being more and more mainstreamed into the building environment. But it seems like a lot of us, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of that, like the big projects going on anymore, or right now at least. It seems like a lot of us on the deeper green building market are being kind of like there's nothing to do anymore because everybody kind of has to build somewhat green. And so I'm wondering if you guys could talk about what you see for the future of, well, certainly straw bale, but this deeper green where it seems like it's being watered down a little bit, where like everybody has to get on board to a certain level, and how that's affecting, is it just market factors that are kind of reducing the amount of big projects, especially in our area? I'm not sure of the national situation as much, but what your thoughts on that are.
Okay. Thank you, Paul.
Uh-huh.
Ken, go ahead. Okay, we just touched the surface. The next thing that's happening now is zero energy buildings. I mean, Title 24 is fine, except I think it's too prescriptive and it's too rigorous.
Define Title 24 for us.
Oh, that's the state energy code.
Okay,
it started in 1980. I was involved at the beginnings of that. Sometime I cuss that because it's gotten more descriptive. That means a formula.
Careful what you wish for.
A formula approach, yeah. But if we got to really performance, not prescription, zero energy is where to go. And we could zero water. Then we ought to be zero carbon. In fact, we ought to be sequestering carbon. And we ought to get into buildings that produce energy that are little power plants too. So we just 5% of this whole green thing. And with the climate crisis we got, that's kicking in really fast, and that's going to – we've just got so much to do. It's just outrageous. Yeah.
Paul's question's a good one, though, because that is a challenge. I mean, I've faced that all the years I've been doing this since the mid-70s, is that I'm sort of always ahead of the curve, then the curve catches up. Then I'm ahead of the curve, and the curve catches up. But Ken's right. I mean, there's still a ways to go, and net zero is the next part, and it's very doable. Many of the houses we have, even, Steve's house, it was never designed as a net zero house, and he does have gas for a little bit of heating and maybe some cooking, but he has a really small photovoltaic system that I think makes up 100% of your electric.
Yeah, we were basically net zero on the electricity until we got an electric car. And now we got to add a few more panels.
Right. I know so it's time to have to add a few panels for the car. But yeah. you get to drive by the gas station and smile. So,
right.
But I think it is a challenge, and we need to just as the deep green builders and part of the community that really cares and is concerned about the global impacts, the climate impacts that building and the use of energy in building makes, that we have to constantly be looking for things in water, in the use of energy to make it even better. You're right, Paul. A lot of these people have to do a basic green stuff, but most of the builders are just doing the minimum they can do. And we as the green builders need to probably push that a little bit and keep pushing it and staying ahead of the curve.
Let me. I don't want to keep the caller on hold for too long. We've got Giselle from Oceano with us. Are you there still?
Yes, I am.
Okay. What are your questions or comments?
Boy, now I've got 10. The more I listen, the more interested I get.
Keep them interesting enough, and we'll let you stay on the line for a while.
It's fantastic. It's a fantastic thing to use alternative materials. But, of course, from my point of view, living in Oceano, what I did was I bought the smallest, worst house on the street, you know, because that's all I could afford. And then I had people from the neighborhood help me fix it up, and that worked. But I would expect the materials, in order to really competitively get straw bales into the construction marketplace, the materials would have to, you know, compete in terms of pricing, because that's what people look at. But my original question was, I've always wondered how straw bale buildings hold up when we get those torrential rains that we get in the 100-year floods. Don't laugh at me, because, you know, I'm not a constructor, but I know that the new materials that they have that interact with concrete to patch it have contained, like, plastic. I don't know if I'm talking about mortar, but can you put that over a straw bale surface to make it more water resilient, or how does it react with water?
Well, I'll let you stay on the line because both Ken and Turco want to jump
chomping
into
at
this.
The bit.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, go ahead, guys.
Ken, go ahead.
Right. Well, actually, the water question is how you do the overhangs and the treatment. You don't want the wall to be totally waterproof, because you want it to breathe. Moisture comes. We produce a lot of moisture inside buildings. You want it to breathe out. So the weep screed at the bottom and the way the overhangs are, all that stuff will take care of the water situation. They've done studies in Oregon, and there's an existing bale building in Huntsville, Alabama, that was built in the 30s, and all these things have held up really good with crazy, that kind of wet weather.
And your idea, they're called plasticizers. They use them to make cement and mortar more waterproof. But you don't want that. You want standard. Actually, the better surfaces for straw bale buildings are either earth plaster or lime plasters. The challenge with them is they are more maintenance, whereas cement stucco. We use a lime cement stucco. That's very important. We add 20 to 25% lime, take out some cement, add some lime, and that makes it a much more breathable outdoor surface, but low maintenance. So you've got to make sure the building breathes. It has to breathe, and you got to put a good hat on top and good shoes on the bottom.
Yeah,
that was
Giselle,
question.
don't go away yet, because Steve wants to jump in this too. So we'll let you stay on the line. But
I just wanted to mention, I think that drainage is a big part of that too, because really, the house where we're at is on a little bit of a saddle point, and so things drain away from that naturally. I mean, maybe people are in low-lying streets, but if you have good drainage, you're not sitting in a puddle and it's not wicking up or doing something like that.
Interesting.
Yeah. Actually, I want to jump in for a second, because I don't live in any house like this, and I'd like to. I live in a pretty much wood frame with drywall house.
Uh-huh.
If you haven't ever had a wood frame drywall typical house, in my case with either stucco on the outside or T111 siding, which is a simple wood siding, when it gets flooded, believe me, you would not find that any of these materials were less reliable because you got to replace everything.
Right.
Oh.
Right.
Yeah.
But Giselle, you bring up an interesting point sort of on the side in that one of the more sustainable things to do is to take existing housing stock and remodel it. We're talking a lot about building new. Straw bale is a challenge. We've done some remodels and some additions, but not very many with straw bale. Usually we're taking houses and we're making them more energy efficient with the wood frame systems they have and floor systems and wall systems. So, and using, you know, some of that older materials too. The nice thing about some of the older materials is they aren't as toxic. They aren't as full of as many chemicals as the newer ones. So if you use those and you work to make your existing home more energy efficient and more comfortable to live in, that's a good solution. And then building smaller. I mean, you know, Steve's home is a perfect example of this.
Yeah.
I forget the size.
It's about 1,000 square feet.
About 1,000 square feet. So, you know, it's the two of them. And, you know, it's not a family of four or eight, but it feels very big inside.
Yeah. It seems like it would be excellent for, you know, like a studio space, people that want to bring the grandmother, you know, back to live on the property or something. But, you know, something like that. It seems like it would be good to start in the market with something like that. I know in Cambria they've doubled in population in 10 years, and they've got a building moratorium. And it's because families expand and the kids come back and they need to put additions. So if I were a contractor, I would market myself in that way. But I guess contractors want to build big subdivisions. Maybe there's less headache.
There's all kinds of different builders out there, and I just think the remodeling and using, you know, decently built housing stock that's here. If there's some crappy stuff that should just be, you know, should just have 5 gallons of remodeling fluid added to it. But most of it is worth remodeling and saving and fixing up. And now it's a challenge sometimes because you can't turn these houses. So Ken's thing of talking about facing south, where the glass goes, the overhangs, has a big impact on how well a house performs in the summer and the winter. So you have to work with that in a remodel.
Giselle, thanks for your call.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Okay.
Well, this is one of those topics that, I think somebody said to me, gee, can you guys actually talk about this for an hour? And the answer is we can probably talk about it for five, but we're running a little short on time. Is there anybody that's tried to do any of this kind of building on, I wouldn't call it a subdivision, but maybe like a co-housing situation? I mean, to some extent, the house that's the Wymans have that's about 1,000 square feet is probably the ideal kind of house to build on co-housing, because it's a small but very livable house. Mm-hmm. I mean, I recall I had a condo in Grover Beach that was half again as big as your house, and it felt like a closet compared to your house. It's a very, very livable space, but it might be an ideal candidate for a co-housing type project.
Yeah, a Tierra Nueva in Oceano, the first co-housing project in the south of San Francisco.
Yeah.
That's all passive solar building.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
But
it would also work for straw bale then, but that wasn't available to them, or they didn't want to go that way.
That was a super tight situation, this thickness.
Okay.
But straw bale would be great for party walls when you get dense housing like that, because that's the other thing, advantage of the sound does not penetrate through the straw bale wall.
Super quiet.
As I recall, there was a competition, something like 2007. I think San Luis Sustainability won some aspect of that, but basically it was a pre-designed second unit, a secondary dwelling that at the time the county was saying you could go through without a permit process if you use that design as is and so on. I mean, so some encouragement of standardized building plans, for example, that are sustainably designed, you know, maybe one way to approach that type of thing.
Yeah, well, we're running down to the end of time here. We've got a couple of calls coming in, so we may not have time for everything. And this is obviously something we're not going to cover everything with. Someone mentioned a type of wall other than straw bale, and I don't recall what the actual...
Oh, I said rammed earth, yes.
Rammed earth, yeah. It just struck me as an unusual term. Can you give us an idea of what that is? And you've got like, you know, 25 words or less.
25 words. Rammed earth is basically putting up two very strong forms and ramming a mixture of earth and a little bit of cement and some gravel into it. The walls are about 18 inches thick. We've done a couple of them here in this county. It's a very expensive way to build, but it's very unique. There's nothing else that looks quite like it because you can literally create a layered sedimentary look. The challenge with it is it's not a good insulator, it has tons of thermal mass, but not a lot of insulation.
So you like to use those inside. Mm-hmm. Straw bales on the outside, rammed earth on the inside. Primo.
Perfect.
Alrighty. Hands down.
We got a couple of calls I'd like to get to. Proverbially, again, people have decided to wait till the last 10 minutes to make us crazy here. It's okay. We got Bruce in Arroyo Grande. Keep it short, Bruce, but thank you. Okay. We can't hear the call, so once you call back in, I'm going to have to drop the call. Okay. We got Maria there on line two in Templeton. You there?
Yes.
Okay. Alrighty. What are your thoughts or questions? You're on the air.
My question is, what is the price of building a straw bale house versus an insulated concrete form?
Okay.
Okay.
All righty.
That's a great question.
We'll have these guys answer that. Thanks for calling. Okay.
So we should define insulated concrete form is also known as ICF by its initials. It is basically a hollowed-out foam block about 12 inches thick. It's got foam on the outsides and webs that hold the two layers of foam together, and you put rebar in the middle and concrete, and you make a structural wall that has foam on both sides. It's a very strong wall. It can carry a lot of weight because essentially it's a concrete building. And it's got good insulation, but it doesn't get you the thermal mass inside the building. The thermal mass is the concrete is trapped between the foam. We've used it on several the Trader Joe's building in Templeton. Those buildings at the Trader Joe's Center in Templeton are made out of insulated concrete forms because they have to hold a lot of weight, and the spans are 80 feet by 120 feet. So, yeah. But it's a good way to build. It's also good because you can build underground with it, like a retaining wall, and have an insulated retaining wall. So it's used a lot in very, very cold climates for that use.
We're down to a few minutes. I wanted to, just for perspective and reference, we think of insulation in the R rating system. I think we used to consider R19 to be an adequate insulation for a wall and a roof. Then we went to R22. I think most buildings requires a minimum of R22 now. What is a straw bale from an insulation?
R33.
Okay, so it's half again as much as the minimum standard that's required from a standpoint of building to code, if you will. Okay, we've got Bruce back on the line. Bruce, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, great. That's terrific. You sounded like you were in outer space before, so thanks for calling back. Okay, what's your thoughts?
Well, is Turco on the line still?
You're on the air with and they're here. So
they haven't put me in the closet yet, Bruce.
Anyway,
hi Turco. This is Bruce Sourance.
Hi Bruce.
Okay.
How you doing,
Arnie?
And I just wanted to tell the audience you're talking to about this new product, which has been used for several years in Germany, and it's just now become available. They've been running prototype lines of it. And it's a phase change material which absorbs, it's embedded in drywall. So it turns drywall into a thermal mass that has the thermal storage capacity of a 4 to 5 inch thick concrete wall. So you're able to get the same type of temperature stabilization that you would get with an adobe or a concrete home or a straw bale home, but with much less expensive. Conventional wood framing, using advanced framing, of course, incorporating passive solar design. And they're building skyscrapers with this material in Germany with no heating and ventilation systems.
Bruce, if we do this, it would be great. Ken and I both know about that product, and we played with it. So let us discuss it on the air, because you do bring up a good idea, and I want to talk about phase change and eutectic salts and some other things like that. So
we're going to let you take the answer off the air. We're running out of time, so I'll let Turco and Ken answer. Thanks for the call.
Well, the nice thing about that product, as it becomes more available and adaptable, is that it eliminates the last extra cost
of a passive solar building. In other words, you eliminate the cost of the mass. Now it's the ball game's over. Mm-hmm. From an economic standpoint, it's cheaper to build passive solar buildings, mm-hmm. period. So,
and Ken, I know you've played – we got some of this drywall, and you played with it and actually did some testing.
Yeah,
in those,
I cast it into tiles.
You cast it into tiles, exactly. Yeah. We played with it in tiles, and it does work.
Yeah.
It does absorb and store.
And they're talking about several companies producing that now, American companies too, as well as the Germans.
Yeah.
It's what it is. It's crazy. It's little
like pellets
little
bottles, or
little bottles of paraffin at a nanotechnology scale. So it looks like the finest grain of sand. If you magnify that with a microscope, you see those are little bottles with a paraffin thing that melts. And thing. Mm-hmm. And the reason they make it so small is then you haven't got the problem that the old eutectic salts always leaked eventually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Made a big mess.
Back in the early days, we used to play with eutectic salts. Ken and I did in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
And we played around because it's the same thing. It was changing from a liquid to a solid on a large scale and taking on and giving off a lot of heat. And they worked great, but they leaked and they were bulky and ugly. Hard
the first ones were done in the 50s by Maria Talkus, who was a woman engineer back in the way.
Yeah, I want to remind folks that we've covered so much material. You can listen to this program. It's archived. Immediately after the program is over, it's archived on our website, and it'll be on the website for at least 2 years, and you can download it so you can hear it again. And we'll try and add some of the websites to the narrative on the website, too, so you can find some other links. We're getting a little low on time. I'm gonna give Steve the last word. He's the guy that isn't a builder and isn't one of the technology guys that jumped in by having a house like this. And we haven't covered nearly everything we can. And I promise we'll talk about this topic some more because there's tons of stuff to cover. But you live in it every day. What do you want to make sure we understand about sustainable building and straw bale houses?
Well, you know, it's not just the technology either. I think it's also the question of the size. We've talked about that. The size plays a lot into the things like the cost and, you know, how many resources we use in the long run. And otherwise, you know, you're talking about with larger spaces, heating and cooling and furnishing and cleaning bigger places. So I hope people consider that and don't overbuild if they don't have to. And as well, there are other materials that make a big difference. We have clay plaster. We've gotten a lot of things like through Green Goods. They delivered materials that were recycled boards and from all kinds of places like Cherry Vets in Oregon. And it's beautiful materials. It's not cutting down the forests that we've got. And with good thought into the design and working with folks like this, we feel very comfortable living in a small and sustainable house.
Yeah. Glad we talked about it, and we've got tons more to talk about. You know, when we first started Central Coast Voices about 2 years ago, talking about this topic and having Turco here talking about it was on the top of my list, so I'm glad that he was finally able to be with us and these other gentlemen. This is Central Coast Voices, and as you may know, this is a project of Action for Healthy Communities. We're glad you're part of the program, and we're glad we can share this with you at KCBX. Want to remind you that next week, Chris Kington Barker is on, and she will be joined by Joel Derringer, the founder and principal of Derringer & Associates. They're a healthcare advocate organization, and Elena Ramirez, who's a covered California certified enrollment counselor with the AIDS Support Network, and they're going to talk about an update on healthcare reform and things that have gone on now as we get to the end of the first year of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Over 95,000 consumers in San Luis Obispo and the surrounding area have signed up for subsidized and non-subsidized housing since the enrollment opened in the start of 2004, and they're going to talk about that. This is Central Coast Voices, and this is a project of Action for Healthy Communities, and your input is important to us. Our email address is voices@kcbx.org. You can reach us by phone at 543-2323. I want to thank Public Radio KCPX for their support of this program and Action for Healthy Communities and the Community Foundation for standing behind this program. We're now second year, almost going on 2 years, and we're delightful to be with you. I want to thank Turco Sims, Ken Haggard, and Steve Wyman for being part of this program today. And This American Life is up next. Thanks for joining us.